It's Friday evening, July 3rd. If you're heading into the holiday weekend, you're likely looking for a clean break from the noise. But a few things shifted in the last few hours that are worth getting on your radar before you sign off. Here's the wrap. The labor market is showing signs of a cooling trend, with non-farm payrolls missing expectations at 57,000 jobs. Following that report, memory chip producers like SK Hynix and Samsung Electronics saw their stock prices take double-digit hits. These aren't just isolated blips. They're symptoms of a hardware supply chain that's starting to look a little precarious. When investors see memory costs rising sixfold, they start wondering if the current infrastructure build-out is a strategic necessity or just another classic tech bubble waiting to pop. It's a brutal pivot point. Companies are now being forced to choose between debt-fueled expansion and a debt diet. That's a shitty situation for any CEO who promised their board a revolutionary AI transformation by next quarter. If the spending doesn't result in clear, case study-backed productivity gains, the market is ready to re-rate those valuations downward, fast. Interestingly, the narrative around AI and jobs is also splitting in two. On one hand, you have the tech sector layoffs, the blunt cost-cutting approach that often ends up backfiring, because turns out, you still need humans to actually run the new systems. On the other hand, data from companies like Ramp and Box shows that firms that lean into AI as an organizational multiplier rather than a substitute are actually growing their headcount by 10% to 12% a year. They're using AI to increase output, which then requires more people to manage the new scale. It's not the job apocalypse the headlines keep screaming about. It's more of a messy, high-friction transformation. But this isn't just about software workflows. It's about the physical reality of the power grid. We're seeing companies like NVIDIA and Valor Atomic looking into small-scale modular nuclear reactors just to keep the lights on. They're trying to decouple AI growth from traditional, water-intensive energy grids that simply weren't built for this level of compute. It's a massive logistical gamble, and it shows that the real competitive moat isn't just having the best model anymore. It's having the power and the infrastructure to actually run the thing without crashing the local utility. The geopolitical tension is just as messy. You've got China effectively treating AI software as a commodity while they double down on the hardware supply chain. They're betting that if they control the physical, foundational layer, they don't need to win the software war in the way the West defines it. Meanwhile, in the US, the government is poking around with the idea of taking equity stakes in frontier labs. It's a move that could turn these companies into public-private hybrids, which might provide some oversight, but could also kill the exact kind of agility that got us here in the first place. There's a clear split happening in the market. You've got firms like Microsoft and Palantir leaning into forward-deployed engineering, sending experts directly into client operations to build bespoke solutions. It's a direct shot across the bow of traditional consulting firms. They're betting that the era of selling generalized AI tools is dying. Instead, they're selling deep, integrated expertise. So, here's the bottom line. The hype cycle is getting replaced by a discipline cycle. The companies that survive this next phase won't be the ones that just throw compute at every problem. They'll be the ones that treat AI as a partner to their existing staff, secure their own infrastructure, and, most importantly, can actually point to a profit margin that doesn't rely on infinite venture capital. It's not about being the smartest person in the room anymore. It's about being the best damn handler of the machine. Whether or not that's enough to keep the market happy, well, that's the billion-dollar question. Speaking of systems that aren't quite holding together, we're seeing a similar kind of structural fragility playing out in the sports world and beyond. The NBA offseason is currently defined by a series of high-profile trades that prioritize immediate star power over long-term structural integrity. The 76ers traded for Paul George, while the Lakers sent draft capital to acquire center Walker Kessler. These moves follow a pattern where teams chase high-ceiling talent to appease superstars or force a championship window open, often ignoring the resulting lack of depth or the potential for tactical friction. It's a classic case of short-term desperation masquerading as a strategy. You have to wonder if these front offices have forgotten that a team is a system, not a fantasy roster. When you trade away your future or your bench for one guy who might get injured, you aren't building a contender. You're building a ticking time bomb. We're seeing a similar tension in international soccer. Spain is finding success in the European tournament by prioritizing a rigid, team-first tactical system, while teams like France lean on individual brains. This Spanish approach creates a high floor, but it's a double-edged sword. Young stars like Lamine Yamal are being forced into strict pressing and passing patterns, which can actually kill the very creativity you need to break down an elite defense in the final minutes. It's the same story with Arsenal's transfer policy. They're chasing interchangeable players to build depth, but the more you optimize for a system that requires everyone to work their ass off the ball, the harder it becomes to sign the mercurial creative types who just don't fit that mold. You end up with a team of high-performing cogs, but you might lose the spark that turns a good season into a trophy. This obsession with systemic control isn't limited to sports. In the thoroughbred racing industry, tracks are proactively canceling races when temperatures hit 105 degrees. It's a shift toward risk-averse, data-driven management to protect the long-term viability of the sport, even if it hurts the betting product in the short term. Meanwhile, in tech, organizations are learning that trying to force enterprise-level complexity onto small-scale infrastructure is a losing game. Whether it's storage architecture or managing human behavior in arts nonprofits, the lesson is the same. When you prioritize administrative control or vague secretive traditions over native transparent systems, you just end up with more technical debt and volunteer burnout. It's funny, right? We're living in a world where everyone has a data-driven model for everything, yet we keep falling into the same traps. We try to regulate human behavior in public pools with dress codes, and instead of compliance, we just get absurd workarounds. We design lottery systems that turn a payout into a public relations liability for the winner. We try to build perfect systems, but the second those systems meet the friction of actual human behavior, they start to crack. Look at the Russian fuel shortage. Ukraine is using drones to strike internal logistics. And now, despite the Kremlin's spin, citizens in Siberia are being limited to 40 liters of fuel a day. It's a perfect example of a cascading failure. You attack the supply chain, and the rigidity of the state apparatus can't handle the pressure. Whether it's a basketball franchise trading away their future, or a software engineer trying to optimize a database with a declarative API like Polar's, the goal should be durability. The teams and companies winning right now are the ones moving away from the star-centric or procedural models that require constant maintenance. They're choosing systems that can actually survive the stress of the real world. Anything else is just a performance. And honestly, it's a shitty way to run a business. When you look at how these systems are being mismanaged, it's rarely an accident. It's usually an ideological choice. The Venezuelan government is facing criticism for its emergency response following recent seismic activity in the region. As the state presence has been described as insufficient, survivors have been left to manage recovery efforts in high-rise areas by hand, without adequate training or equipment. This isn't just a logistical breakdown, it's the privatization of disaster. When people are left to recover their own, the state isn't just absent, it's actively fostering a deep, volatile resentment that will outlast the cleanup. Look, when the government stops doing the one thing it's fundamentally supposed to do, protect its people, it creates a vacuum. That vacuum gets filled by trauma, exhaustion, and eventually, a total loss of faith in any central authority. It's a recurring theme right now, whether it's Venezuelan families digging through concrete or the British government funneling NHS resources into US pharmaceutical partnerships, the story is the same. Institutions are prioritizing their own survival or corporate interests over the actual physical safety of the people they report to represent. In the UK, a trade deal was pushed through via a statutory instrument, bypassing parliamentary debate. They're hiding the impact assessments behind a wall of commercial sensitivity. It's a hell of a thing to watch a government treat its own healthcare system like a line item in a trade negotiation. Meanwhile, here at home, we're seeing a total breakdown of neutral civic symbols. The 250th anniversary of the United States, which should be a baseline national milestone, has been turned into a partisan brand war. You've got the Freedom 250 Project running parallel to the official Congressional Commission, complete with political rallies and branding. It's not about history anymore. It's about who gets to claim the logo. When the symbols of the state become nothing more than campaign props, the idea of a shared national narrative doesn't just fray, it snaps. This is exactly why we're seeing the rise of fighter brand strategies, like what the Democratic Socialists of America are doing. They've decided that the traditional, polite coalition building of the establishment is a dead end. Instead, they're running insurgent primary campaigns, targeting incumbents, and forcing topics like military aid to Israel into the center of the debate. They aren't necessarily looking to win every seat tomorrow. They're looking to break the inevitability of the status quo. It's a high-risk gamble. By treating the party establishment as an opponent rather than a partner, the DSA is pushing the Overton window, sure, but they're also risking internal fracture. You see the same energy in the Democratic Party's anxiety over the 2028 map. They're trying to balance moderate voters against a base that is absolutely fed up with performative politics. Candidates are finding that long-term incumbency is becoming a liability, which is a hell of a shift for a party that usually relies on tenure and tradition. Stacey Abrams and Jane Fonda are arguing that the only way out of this is through organized, strategic non-cooperation. They're saying that if you want to stop the erosion of democracy, you have to stop looking at the federal level and start winning school boards and city councils. They're pushing for actual, local network building, basically making sure you know your neighbors so that when the state fails or when the institutions go off the rails, you aren't entirely on your own. It's a grim reality, but it's the only one that makes sense right now. Whether you're looking at the collapse of infrastructure in Venezuela or the weaponization of history in D.C., the trend is clear. The institutions that are supposed to hold things together are either failing or they're being hollowed out for parts. If you're waiting for the system to correct itself, you're probably going to be waiting a long time. The question isn't whether the trust is gone. The question is what you do once you realize you're the one who has to rebuild it. And if you're trying to rebuild anything, you have to start with your own head. Founder anxiety is no longer just a personal burden. It's being categorized as a systemic operational liability. Recent analysis of leadership dynamics suggests that when founders mistake hypervigilance for high standards, they create a defensive culture that kills innovation. The chain of events is predictable. A founding company's unmanaged panic leads to micromanagement, which forces employees to prioritize error avoidance over problem solving. This isn't just bad vibes, it's a measurable drag on revenue and market competitiveness. The fix being proposed is to treat emotional regulation as a hard KPI, right alongside sales targets or burn rate. If you lead from a place of fear, you effectively bottleneck the entire organization. It's a compelling argument because it strips away the ego, framing mental stability as a high-leverage business activity rather than a self-care luxury. This theme of internal management ripples out into how we handle our daily lives. There is a strong push right now to stop blaming external circumstances for our reactive habits. Experts are arguing that well-being isn't waiting for your environment to change, because it won't, but rather in mastering your own internal state. The sequence is mechanical. Thoughts turn into words, which become actions, then habits, and finally, your character. The suggested intervention here is almost clinical. You change the structure of your day, 15 minutes of introspection in the morning, gratitude practice at night, to break the cycle of external dependency. It's a shift from thinking about your problems to changing the architecture of your response. But there's a tension here when you look at the broader digital landscape. While some are pushing for internal mastery, others are warning that we are losing the war for cognitive sovereignty. There is a growing argument that we're repeating a historical cycle of over-reliance on technology, one that's actively leading to cognitive atrophy. We are seeing the first generation of digital natives score lower on IQ tests than their predecessors, which is being framed as a direct result of outsourcing our decision-making to AI. It gets a bit darker. Some are framing the refusal to use biometric data or total digital integration not just as a preference, but as a moral choice to maintain human agency. The argument is that if you don't set hard boundaries against algorithmic control, you aren't just losing time, you're losing your capacity for independent thought. This friction between the need for systems and the danger of dependency shows up in the creator economy too. Creators are finding that success is increasingly fragile when it's tied to external validation and algorithmic trends. The ones who survive the inevitable burnout are the ones who ground their work in an authentic identity rather than chasing vanity metrics. But even then, there's a catch. Relying on AI to script or edit that content for efficiency can erode the very human element that built the audience in the first place. It's a shitty paradox. You need the tech to compete, but the tech is the thing that makes you replaceable. We're also seeing a pivot toward assertive boundary setting as a survival skill. Former intelligence operatives are pointing out that predatory behavior, whether in human trafficking or online scams, relies on a specific playbook: artificial urgency, flattery, and the weaponization of social politeness. We are conditioned to be nice, and predators use that to bypass our natural fight-or-flight instincts. The defense isn't just about avoiding bad neighborhoods anymore. It's about slow-walking every interaction that demands an immediate, emotional response. Which brings us back to the most practical, if somewhat dry, solution: externalizing your commitments. The getting things done approach argues that the brain is for having ideas, not holding them. When you keep your to-do list in your head, you're basically running a background process that eats up all your RAM. By dumping every obligation onto paper, you stop your brain from treating a project deadline and a grocery run as the same level of existential threat. It's the ultimate form of cognitive sovereignty. Because if you don't know what you're not doing, you can never feel good about what you are doing. Ultimately, these perspectives are all pointing toward the same conclusion: your internal state is the only thing you have any real leverage over. Whether it's a founder's anxiety, a creator's ego, or the digital noise of the average person, the solution is the same. Take the inputs out of your head, build a structure that forces a pause, and stop letting the environment define your next move. It's not revolutionary, but it's the only way to avoid becoming an automated accessory to your own life. Before I let you go, a few quick takes to round out the day. First, if you're still betting on the China as a growth engine playbook, you're about a decade behind. Chinese manufacturing is now hitting Western quality standards, which means American brands aren't just sourcing from there anymore. They're getting their asses kicked by local competitors who can do the same thing for less. Next, the business of keeping celebrities private has turned into a goddamn military operation. We're talking drone surveillance, burner phone sweeps, and physical perimeters that look more like an embassy protection detail than a wedding. Honestly, it's a lot of effort just to keep a few photos off Instagram. If you're looking at soccer betting markets, stop assuming they're smart. International tournaments are inherently inefficient because these teams barely practice together, making the data sets so small they're practically useless compared to the year-round grind of club football. And finally, for the portfolio nerds, stop chasing yield and start looking at bond ladders. By matching your maturity dates to your actual bills, you're just removing the guesswork that usually blows up standard funds when the market gets moody. Anyway, that's the state of things. That's your wrap for the week. Enjoy the holiday, stay safe, and I'll see you on the other side.